I'm Sandy Fahler from the University of Wisconsin-Madison Oral History Project. Today is Friday, April 14, 2006. I'm interviewing Molly Carnes, Jean Manchester Biddick, Professor of Women's Health Research and Co-Director of the Women in Science and Engineering Leadership Institute, also known as WISELY. We're going to start today with the beginning of your life, where you were born, when you were born, where you went to elementary school, high school. Talk about any family members or others, teachers, who encouraged you in your studies when you were young. Younger.
Oh, thank you. So should I just start with the questions that you gave
sure.
me here?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, it says, where and when were you born? So I was born in Youngstown, Ohio. On Pole and Canfield Road, August 15th, 1951. And
that's where you went to elementary school?
No, we lived out in the country. We lived there till I was three, and my brother was six. And then we moved to Memphis, Tennessee. My father was a Unitarian minister, Unitarian Universalist minister. And he took the Memphis church when I was 3 years old. So we moved down there, and then when I was six, we moved to Buffalo, New York. But I started first grade in Memphis, and you know, you don't remember a lot about it. I remember it was sunny, and I remember I thought some of the southern accents were interesting. I have this vivid memory of playing with the clovers on our front lawn, and the father of a neighbor girl walking into his house and saying, "Hey, sugar, have you seen Dean?" The daughter's name was Dean. So I remember little snippets that. And my mom was really quite a rabble-rouser. She had been a wave in the first group of women that were allowed officially in the military. You know, before mm-hmm. that, there was the Nurses Army Corps. But there, women weren't really considered enlisted military until Roosevelt signed something, I think, in 1942. And so she was in that first wave of waves. And anyway, so she really was pretty advanced or pretty progressive. And so, of course, she had the GI Bill, and she came back, and she'd gone to Smith, and she'd taken all this stuff. And so then they were in Youngstown, Ohio, and she was going down twice a week working on her master's in education at Western Reserve. It wasn't Case Western then, it was Western Reserve. Mm-hmm. And she would spend the night with one of my dad's prisoner of war buddies who was in Ohio. So, you know, she was really quite advanced in education. She was doing early childhood education. Then they went to Memphis. Mm-hmm. And from the stories they tell, there was like no preschool. Everybody was so far behind. Mm-hmm. And so she started a cooperative nursery school while we were in Memphis. And so that was my first school, because I went there mm-hmm. The days my mom was working. And then I went to first grade there. I remember Miss Johnson. She was young and beautiful. And yeah, I don't remember much about it. I was trying to think the things you remember. I remember walking to school and getting lost the first day, and some older student who looked really old, was probably like in sixth grade, you know, showing me the way. And
you had the one brother?
I had one brother, yep. Mm-hmm. He was 18 months older. He also went there. And then we moved to Buffalo in the middle of winter. So we went from this, you know, fairly temperate winter. We drove to Buffalo and hit a snowstorm around Erie, Pennsylvania. And, you know, I thought that was kind of cool, all the snow. And then I remember saying how gray Buffalo was. You know, I remember thinking of Memphis in bright colors. I drew a picture like Memphis in bright colors and Buffalo all gray. But actually, Buffalo was a wonderful place to live. We lived in downtown Buffalo. My dad was minister of the Buffalo Unitarian Church, and my mom worked eventually she was an assistant professor at the State College. But, you know, we were there for, I think, 20 years, and through the Vietnam War, and because Unitarianism was pretty liberal. So my dad was active in the civil rights movement. He marched in Selma. He was very active locally in civil rights, and our church took a kind of anti-war stance, and we gave symbolic sanctuary to some of the draft dodgers. So, I mean, it was really mm-hmm. quite an exciting time to be there. And then they, I went to the University of Michigan for college because I thought I was going to major in languages. And
did you like science when you were in high school?
Well, I always liked science. Yeah, mm-hmm. I did. Mm-hmm. I did. But I did pretty much, you know, I liked studying. I liked learning. So I was pretty much, you know, good at everything, which made it a little bit hard. And I went to college, and I remember not, you know, it was a turbulent time. My first year in college, University of Michigan shut down. I never even took my finals in the spring. Mm-hmm. There was the Black Action Movement, and there were picket lines. And so I dropped out of school the second year for about half a year.
Can you back up just a minute? Why did you pick the University of Michigan?
Well, I was interested in languages. Mm-hmm. I had taken German and French, which were the only two languages available in my high school. And they had a strong language program. And then I had a babysitter who was at the University of Michigan, and a former babysitter. And so I went there and stayed with her, and it just looked like so much fun. You know, uh-huh. She was having students in her house teaching a class. And, of course, Ann Arbor is a lot like Madison. You can't help but just love it. It's mm-hmm. alive, and everything is about education. And I think that was part of my family culture. So I just knew I wanted to go there.
And how was your education financed, your college, your undergraduate
education?
Well,
my parents, because education was so important to my parents, they always said, you can go wherever you want to college. I mean, I think they started saving for my education before I was born. Mm-hmm. And that was really nice, because out-of-state tuition at Michigan was, you know, almost comparable to an Ivy League school. It mm-hmm. was a lot. But they let me go wherever I wanted. Then for extra stuff, I had to work. So I always did a little bit of stuff, you know, mm-hmm. waited tables, or had this one really great job in Ann Arbor. Upjohn, I guess, it's in Michigan, and there must be something Upjohn in Madison. But anyway, they had these things called Upjohn Homemakers. And I remember the green and white uniform. And they had different programs. You could go in people's houses and clean and stuff. But I was a bed sitter. We have them here in the hospital. So I would simply be assigned. I'd go and check in, and they'd tell me what room I would go to. And I really was. I got to do my homework. I sat by the bed. Mm-hmm. And if the patient got delirious or thrashed about, I went and got the nurse. That was pretty much all I had to do. So it was a great job. And then I cleaned houses, too.
And then you dropped out for a little while, you said, just because of everything that was going on.
Well, I think so. Oh, and I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I think I was caught up in kind of that identity crisis, turbulent time. And so I followed a hippie for a little while down in North Carolina. And then I went and worked at a ski area for a while in Colorado. And I learned that as an unskilled woman, there was not much you could do. So I wanted to go to school in whatever took the longest, and that was academic medicine.
So you went back to Michigan?
I went back to Michigan. Uh-huh. Because they allowed you, it was like a kind of a trimester thing where you could take any two of three semesters and still be enrolled. So even though I dropped out for the winter semester and took all the winter off, I was still able to enroll in the fall and still I didn't have to re-enroll. Mm-hmm. And then I just finished off by going to summer school. And I was one semester late finishing off, but it was still in the same academic year.
Mm-hmm. And were there professors there that you had that influenced you to go further into medicine?
No, it was my dad. Mm-hmm. I remember when I was kind of, you know, lost, I remember sitting with him. I think it was on the bed in my dorm even, say, when he came to pick me up for Christmas or something. I was like, I don't know what I want to do. And there was this young woman down the hall who was in nursing school. And I said, you know, I'm thinking maybe I'll go to nursing school. And I remember he said, why not medicine? Why not medical school? And I don't know. Why not? You know? So that was really a crystallizing moment. Huh. Mm-hmm. And I think how many dads would have said, well, that's a good idea. I think you'd make a good nurse, and I would be a nurse today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you graduated from the University of Michigan.
Then I went to medical school at University of Buffalo. And even though my parents were there when I started, after my first year, My dad was elected president of the Unitarian Universalist Association, so they actually moved to Boston, even though I was still in Buffalo. And I finished there, and then I met my future husband there, and we came here in 78. Same kind of thing with Ann Arbor. You know, we came here to interview. We fell in love with Madison, and we could just see ourselves here, and we've been here ever since. Did my internal medicine here, then geriatrics, then I did a neuroendocrine fellowship, came on faculty. I don't know, one thing led to another, got tenure, and here I am.
And your husband's a physician here, too?
He's a physician here. He's the vice chair for education in the Department of Medicine.
Oh, okay. So you went through all of that, and you just wanted to stay in Madison.
There was no question.
Right,
there was no question. In fact, I remember saying, we have to figure out how to stay in Madison. And we did. We both found a niche. So he found education and HIV/AIDS. He co-directed that clinic when it was just starting. And geriatrics didn't really exist. It was kind of fledgling. And so that was, I kind of built as my niche.
Well, how does that, so you were a physician with the university hospital and a member of the faculty.
Right.
And that's continued today.
Right.
Okay. But now you were telling me that Meritor, how are you affiliated with Meritor?
Oh, that's
then?
A long story. Oh. I'm also affiliated with the VA. Actually, my only clinical work right now is at the VA. And the VA actually was supported my career development. My lab was at the VA, and I had a VA Career Development Award. Because I don't know if you know how the medical school works, but they're very much joined with the VA, a lot of faculty, a lot of patient care and clinical stuff. And the VA had a lot of opportunities in geriatrics. They actually invested early on in geriatrics because the veterans were aging. You know, those World War II veterans were coming along. And in fact, the growth of academic geriatrics really happened because the VA trained all these academic geriatricians, and then they kind of went to academic settings and developed curricula and stuff like that. So anyway, the Meritor piece came because, after I got tenure based on my rat research, I looked around and I realized I was the only tenured woman in the entire Department of Medicine, which is the largest department in the entire university. And that got my attention. I mean, I had not really noticed it in geriatrics because there wasn't really anybody in charge of geriatrics. It was sort of learn and do one, teach one. Mm-hmm. And my teachers were largely, you know, nurses, physical therapists, speech pathologists, allied, and they were mostly women. So even though I was the only physician, I was really in a group of women, and I had not realized how few women there were in academic medicine until I found myself the only woman in my department. So that got my attention, and I decided I would close my lab. And I had been a chair of an NIH study section, and I knew that there were all these kind of training grants through aging. And I remember calling the program officer and saying, you know, women's health is really a lot like geriatrics in terms of, you know, it's a vulnerable group of patients, it's not well served by the current models. And I said, and you know, most geriatric patients are women. You need these programs and older women's health. Mm-hmm. And the program officer said, well, write one. So I got this 5-year leadership award basically to allow myself to go back to school and get a master's in epidemiology. And they changed it to population health while I was in it. And my goal was to then study the absence of women in academic medicine from sort of a disease standpoint. Like, what is killing off these healthy young medical students so that they're dead by the time they get to the professor level, you know? And then I had to, I had 5 years of good support from the NIH to kind of develop myself, develop curriculum, and I wrote just a whole bunch of grants during that time. We got the National Center of Excellence, and once we got the National Center of Excellence, we needed space, and I felt like the little hen, you know, will you help me plant the corn? Will you help me? No, nobody would help me. First then we got the center and everybody wanted a piece. But the only person who was, only system that kind of got it, could kind of see where we were trying to go, was Meritor. Mm. And they have, of course, housed all the OBGYN training for the university for over 20 years. Mm-hmm. And they kind of see women's health as, you know, something they do. So even though we were a little different, you know, me being a geriatrician and us being an academic program, they could see that it was a good fit. Mm-hmm. So they welcomed us actually over in the hospital. But now they're remodeling and they needed our space. We were there until just recently. That's where our computers don't work because we're sort of new in this space.
I see.
Then they were very nice and they said, well, we, you know, you bring, you're part of our portfolio. So mm-hmm. they're renting us this space.
They have
been wonderful mm-hmm. to us.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now I made you jump ahead because I asked that question on about Meritor, but I have to ask you to go back and talk about your rat research.
Oh, well, I discovered that ACTH is secreted in frequent bursts throughout the day. Stress hormones. So mm-hmm. the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal cortical axis is kind of the stress hormonal axis. And it's been well known for a long time that it varies across the day in a circadian type rhythm. And many other hormones are secreted in pulsatile bursts, and nobody had really examined the high frequency variation in ACTH or cortisol, and you mm-hmm. can't really do that unless you sample frequently. So I looked at all the studies and I saw, well, the reason people are only seeing this big change over 24 hours is because people are sampling like every 6 hours. So I developed this rat model where I transfused rats and then slowly drew blood from them, and I could sample every minute for like 3 hours. And we discovered that ACTH is secreted in rapid pulsatile bursts. But the problem was, it wasn't really clinically relevant, and everything was becoming molecular, and the assays were getting too expensive. So it was either kind of redirect and become more molecular or do something that I really felt passionate about. And I tried for a while. I took a molecular biology course, and it was like, I've been dealing with all this dynamic data. I could never get up in the morning and be excited about a gel. So I just decided I was going to go in a completely different direction.
Now, you must have had people that you worked with that helped you all along, mentors in medical school and here when you got here. Can you talk about some of them?
Well, I had like the mosaic mentors. So my clinical mentors really were largely non-physicians because nobody was really doing geriatrics. Mm-hmm. So Peg Brown, who's now dead, was a nurse at the VA. There were physical therapists there, pharmacists there, a whole team of people. Then from the research side, Ned Kalin, who had just come from NIMH, he's now chair of psychiatry. I approached him because there were some interesting interfaces with depression and geriatrics, and, mm-hmm. and it was kind of a new field looking at depression in older patients. And he was interested, he was a biological psychiatrist interested in depression. So I did a clinical project with him, and then I approached him about being a mentor for me on this Stettler grant, which is Pearl Stettler was a woman physician, and no man would allow her to work in their lab at Johns Hopkins. So when she died, she left this big endowment just for women physicians who wanted to do research. So I had that for 2 years, and he was my mentor. And then I wrote for this NIH career development grant. Well, I guess first I had a VA career development grant, then I wrote for an NIH career development grant. And Ned was my mentor. And then I worked with Mark Brownfield in the School of Veterinary Medicine. Mm-hmm. So I had kind of a mosaic of mentors.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk about the tenure process here? You said you got tenure here. Anything unusual happened as far as you were concerned, or was what you expected?
Well, you know, being in the clinical department, I mean, nobody really talked to me about. I just knew I had to do research, write papers, and get grants. I mean, I just knew that. I don't think I even had a letter of offer. I mean, it was so different back then. It was like, succeed. You know, I don't think anybody really. And so I remember Don Harkness was the chair, and he, you know, told me I was coming up for tenure and I had to submit all these documents and stuff. And it was actually kind of fun. It was sort of like reminiscence therapy. You know, you had to go through each one of your publications and talk about who did what. So I submitted, but I wasn't really that worried about it. I didn't pay too much attention to it. And then I got tenure. I mean, I didn't actually even realize what a big deal it was because it was so foreign. You know, nobody around me was getting tenure. In fact, I don't remember one other single, well, of course, there were no other women on the tenure track. Maybe that's why I don't remember. But so I didn't really realize what a big deal it was until later. But there was no anxiety around tenure at all. Well, I mean, I just did what they told me to do and submitted the materials and, oh, yeah, got tenure. I mean, it wasn't really anything that I even knew I should be nervous about.
That's rather unusual, isn't it?
Well, but, you know, I was paid full-time at the VA. I was pretty secure that I would have a job as a physician. Mm-hmm. So I guess, and I think hopefully this is changing, but there was no encouragement to interact beyond the medical school. So I had no idea until later what tenure actually gave you entry to. Because the medical school's very insular, and of course here I was, you know, raising my kids, writing my paper. There wasn't really any time to even look up. So I had this job at the VA. I loved working at the VA. I had my grants. So tenure was just something like, well, it didn't really matter.
Just another step.
And if I didn't get it, nothing was really going to change.
Well, that's very interesting. Now, do you teach now? And have you taught most of your career?
Well, I teach now, but it's not classes. So teaching in the medical school is a little different. It's more sort of an apprenticeship model. Mm-hmm. So it's in a clinical setting. Mm-hmm. So you supervise physicians or physicians in training at different levels. And so as I've gotten into more kind of institutional research, and I started out with rats and I went to patients, now I'm sort of doing institutional research. The only clinical work I do now is at the VA. So I have a group of 12 residents that are assigned to me for 3 years. And then I have pharmacy students that I supervise in the clinic. So that's my teaching. I don't have classes. Well, actually, it's not true. I just started a new course with a professor in the School of Nursing that we started last year. So I am teaching that this summer.
What's that?
It's clinical research evidence. So as a librarian, we work with the librarians. We work with Rika because, you know, clinical research synthesis has become a science in and of itself. And I'm principal investigator of a career development grant from the NIH. Mm-hmm. And we realized that if we're going to create successful academic health scientists of various ilks, we need to teach them how to search, you know, research databases and synthesize that and do systematic reviews, or at least what a systematic review is. So we put together this course.
Okay. And the librarian is part of it, you say? Oh, okay. Very good. Are there any students that you've, in the clinical setting, that stand out in your mind that you've had over the years that you have followed their career or are particularly proud of or interested in?
Oh, yeah, quite a few. Well, particularly proud of, I would say, Jane Mahoney, who's now a tenured associate professor here. She's on the Biological Sciences Tenure Divisional Committee, and she's doing groundbreaking research on falls in the community. She is awesome. And then she's the most senior one. And then Lisa Boyle was a minority high school student that worked in my lab for a few years, and she's now a psychiatrist, a postdoc. She's going to have an academic career. She's at University of Rochester. And then Hain Vo is a Vietnamese, now she's a physician. She was a student trying to get into medical school, and she worked in my lab for a few years, and now she's a practicing OBGYN in the Wausau area.
You've talked quite a bit about getting grants and describe how your research was funded and is funded, and that's a big part of your job still, right, is getting grants so you can do all of these things that you want.
Well, everything you see is on soft money. But when the state budget was cut,
soft money was looking really good. People who thought they were on hard money were losing their jobs, and we were hiring.
Right.
Yeah, so it's, you know, it's not as bad as... I kind of like being on soft money, because if you bring in your own money, you get to kind of decide what you want to do, who you want to play with, who you want to hire, what your goals are, mm-hmm. and nobody can tell you what to do, mm-hmm. which I really like.
Makes a lot of sense. Okay.
I mean, as long as you don't break a law or anything like that.
Right. Oh, no. Right. Exactly. I think this is a relevant question, and I know you've talked a little bit about it when you talked about the rats. Where did your research interests come from? And just if you would talk a little bit more about it, especially when you switched fields, or not fields, but when you were working with the rats and you said, I don't really want to do this for the rest of my life, and then you went in a different direction. Are you starting over then when you do something like that, or you just building?
Well, I mean, once you have tenure, I guess it is, it's the time to do it. I mean, I must have subconsciously kind of recognized it. Plus, it was the end of a grant, and I had developed a cutaneous and respiratory allergy to the rodents. So, you know, there were a lot of signs that it was time to do something else. And I guess some of it was just sort of a confluence of events. So I got tenure in 1990. In 1989, the Office of Research on Women's Health formed in response to the Government Accounting Office report that showed the NIH was only spending 13% of its budget on diseases that were unique to or more common in women. Hmm. And the Office of Research on Women's Health came out and it said, our tripartite mission is to increase the number of women involved in clinical research and study of conditions of women, to increase studies in women, increase enrollment of women in clinical trials, and increase the number of women in academic leadership positions. And that was just sort of like an aha. I said, oh, I could do that. You know that? And isn't geriatrics really just older women's health? And so I saw that I was sort of in the right place at the right time, because mm-hmm. I knew how to write grants. I knew about these K awards, these KO7s, these kind of midlife transition awards, because I had been on the study section reviewing them. And I just sort of felt like, you know, I can do this. And I have tenure, I'm, you know, at the University of Wisconsin, and we have all, and I had built sort of a network of academic contacts around campus through aging, which again is largely women's health. So, mm-hmm. you know, people like Marcia Seltzer, Carol Riff, I knew all these people networked through the aging network. So when I wrote the grant, I just brought them in and just kind of framed it as older women's health.
Okay, I get it. What do you consider to be your most important contribution to the field so far?
Well, yeah, I hope it hasn't happened.
No.
But, well, what is my most important contribution to the field? That's a good question. I guess I'm a program developer. I love to build programs, multidisciplinary programs that bring things together. So I guess if you look back, my academic career has been characterized by building programs. So, you know, geriatrics is now thriving. I mean, it's one of the most successful programs in medicine, and I'm still in that section, although I don't do much with them anymore. But, you know, I was one of the people who helped build that program and mm-hmm. launch it. That was mm-hmm. great. And academic programs in women's health, we have one of the largest academic programs in women's health in the country. And, you know, it started just with an idea. Mm-hmm. And Wisely, you know, even the name Wisely, that was my idea. You know, it's sort of exciting to kind of put these things together. The life cycle research grants, you know, I made that up. And now it's endowed by the Vilas Trust, you know. So I love that kind of thing. And now I'm working on this, this NIH grant that I got last year. This team program is also multidisciplinary and one of the roadmap K-12, one of the roadmap, I don't know, you probably don't follow the NIH stuff, but when Zerhuni became head of the NIH, he launched this roadmap and there were these big training grants available. And so 7 were funded, and we were one of those out of 70 proposals, and mm-hmm. they're big deal. So it's like $14 million over 5 years.
And that's a lot of fun, yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, I like to build programs.
Okay. Now, would you talk about Wisely? How did that get formed, and why did it get formed? I mean, I've read a little bit about it, and I've heard about it from other faculty on the campus, but you've been very much involved in it, probably as much as anybody, if not more. So could you talk about that a little bit?
Oh, sure. Well, I had, because of my interest in the medical school, you know, we did a gender climate survey in the medical school and published it in like 1997. And, you know, so I'd sort of, and with this leadership award with the NIH, I mean, it was, I think I was sort of becoming recognized as being interested in women in medicine, advancing careers for women in medicine.
Mm-hmm.
In the medical school. And then I knew Janet Hyde, and somehow, I don't know if she recommended me, I can't remember how it happened, but I was on the advisory board for the Women's Faculty Mentoring Program for the campus. Janet was chair of it, and then I guess she recommended me to be chair after her. So that was sort of my first broad campus activity related to women outside the medical school. But it got, so I was sort of known, recognized as being interested in women's issues. So when the request for proposals came out from NSF for these institutional transformation awards to mm-hmm. increase the participation and advancement of women in academic science and engineering, I think six people sent me that RFP. So I was going to go for it. And I remember Joe Handelsman was going to go. There were institutional transformation awards and there were leadership awards. And Joe was going to go for a leadership award. That's to an individual person. And I wanted to go for the big one, the institutional transformation awards. So I contacted the NSF. I said, well, can you go for both? And the response was, why don't you just include the leadership piece in the transformation? So then Joe and I decided we would go as co-investigators.
Mm-hmm.
So I you have to have one. So I'm actually the PI, but we've functioned as co-investigators and we're co-directors of Wisely. And yeah, I remember just making up that name, and Joe and I were meeting and bouncing ideas off each other, and I said, well, how about this, the Women in Science and Engineering Leaders, Wisely. And we kind of joked, we said, rhymes with Wiley, and he had just become chancellor. And then we got it, and we were very excited. The reviews were, I mean, in the summary of the reviews, one person had written, fund this one. I never had such good reviews. And, you know, so to get such a big grant to do what you really wanted to do, I mean, it's been the best grant. And then it was just sort of, I don't know, destiny, kismet, whatever, that when I was to complete my master's, I was doing a project with Bob Hauser, looking at the Wisconsin longitudinal data set, and mm-hmm. I was interested to see whether a history of child abuse, how it related to a number of health measures, physical and mental health measures later in life. And even though I had master's in epidemiology, you know, a master's is sort of like a research appreciation course. You can't actually do a lot of the analyses. So I was over there struggling. I was practically in tears struggling to try to analyze these data. And Tess Hauser, bless her heart, could see that I was just about to melt. You know Tess Hauser.
I know who she is.
So she said, oh, well, Jen, she called over Jen Sheridan, who was a doctoral student at that time. She said, can you help this poor physician? You know, I'm struggling to pay. And so Jen was wonderful. I went to her office, and she just like quick blip, 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 she did these analyses. And so we sort of started to collaborate on this. And then when she was done, she kind of wanted to stay in Madison, and I had a position for a postdoc on our center. So I was paying her as a postdoc in the center, and then mm-hmm. when we got Wisely, I remember coming to her and saying, we need a kind of an overview, a scientist, you know, to help us coordinate things, not really an administrator, but they would have administrative duties, but we need them to analyze data. And I said, do you know any sociologists? And she said, well, I think I'd love to do that. And I'm like, duh. So we had a couple of other applicants, but Jen was, you know, so much more superior. She had the quantitative background. She had the social science background. Hmm. She was
visionary, brilliant, easy to work with. I mean, she is just fabulous. It is all about who you can hire, isn't
mm-hmm.
it?
Mm-hmm.
And so the three of us have really worked together as a team from the beginning.
And what have been the successes?
Well, lots of things. In terms of institutionalization, we had this view of the life cycle research grant.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And we said, you know, a lot of people, a lot of excellent researchers have unexpected things happen to them in their personal life, either their own health, the health of a loved one, they become caregivers, they're pregnant, they're in bed for 3 months, and that jeopardizes their research career. And if we at UW-Madison are really invested in this whole person, we need some kind of research fund that gets them over that. Because the current graduate school research funds might get them over a funding gap or allow them to start something new, but it's all aimed at their research, not the researcher.
Mm-hmm.
So we wanted to change the paradigm, and so we specifically made these for that.
Mm-hmm.
And we viewed them as being low-threshold grants that people could get. We had 2 or 3 cycles a year, and we budgeted for that in our grant, and then we had a large evaluation piece. So every time we would do something, then we would evaluate it. And the evaluation of it just showed, you know, it was phenomenal. People were saying things like, you know, it gave me a ray of hope. I was so discouraged. I didn't know what to do. And then I got this grant.
Can you give me an example? You don't have to mention any names, but give me an example of how it helped somebody. I'm really interested in that.
Well, this would be sort of a typical scenario.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody would be an assistant professor. Things were going along fine. And they got pregnant and had to go to bed rest for 4 months.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So they couldn't write their next grant that would keep their grad student funded or their technician funded or fund their preliminary, their lab would basically close down while they were at bed rest. They couldn't keep things going.
Right.
So this was enough money to come in and pay that graduate student or pay that assistant to get them over that gap till then they could pick up their research career.
Sure.
And we now have evidence. Our evaluators kept in touch with the people who've had these. And again, cause and effect is very hard to show. But they say, because of this grant, I've now been able to submit an NIH grant, and I have, you know, $2 million.
Mm-hmm.
So because of the life cycle grant, I was able to get these 3 extra publications out, and
mm-hmm.
that's allowed me to get tenure. So whether they would have been able to do it or not, they at least feel these grants really allowed them to survive.
Sure.
Basically, academic survival.
Yeah. Now, how many people have taken advantage of this?
We have the Vilas Trust is endowing it, $350,000 a year, and we keep doing them. So it's at least 20 now, maybe 27.
That's great.
And it's such a good thing. Like when we send the email out, we'll get responses, even from people who aren't going to apply, and they'll say, just knowing this kind of grant is available really makes me feel good about UW-Madison. Or someone said, I knew this was a great place to work, and this just really, you know, underscores it.
Yeah.
So it gives back in many, many ways. And not just women have gotten them. It's mostly women,
mm-hmm.
just because women are more vulnerable at that time in life with reproduction, and they also have more caregiving responsibilities.
Sure.
But we've also, 2 have gone to men.
And what does an announcement go out to all mm-hmm. assistant professors at some point? Or,
well, when we were doing it just with Wisely, it went out to everyone. It goes to deans, chairs, it goes out.
Okay.
We were only doing the 6 schools and colleges that have biological and physical science in them, because that's what we work for NSF.
Mm-hmm.
But now that it's funded with the Vilas Trust, it goes across campus. So humanities, social science, everybody gets
mm-hmm.
the announcement.
Mm-hmm.
And we get about, I guess, maybe 6 to 8 applications each time.
Really?
And we fund maybe 3 or 4.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it's really hard to pick them.
Oh, I bet. Yeah. And there really isn't any other option for people, right?
Mm-mm.
Well, that is definitely a success. Well, in relation to that, would you discuss the climate for women on the Madison campus? How it helps or hinders participation and advancement of women?
Well, it varies a lot. We're so huge.
Mm-hmm.
The best thing for me was working beyond the medical school, because quite frankly, the climate for women in the medical school is awful.
It's been a lot in the paper.
Oh. And it was, I thank Janet Hyde for bringing me on to the advisory committee for the Women Faculty Mentoring Program. That was the first time I had worked outside the medical school. And then, you know, the other activities just kept bringing me outside the medical school. I just love working in the College of Engineering. Hmm. I love it. It's just so nice. And interacting with Letters and Sciences and, you know, the grad school and even within the Health Sciences, School of Pharmacy, School of Nursing, the Vet School. You know, I just... I enjoy it so much more. It's just, some of it is just basic respect. Mm-hmm. You know, when I am involved in a meeting or a group session, any kind of meeting on campus, you know, I feel everybody's sort of at an equal level. We listen to each other, there's exchange, there's just, you know, sort of decency, respect. Mm-hmm. In the medical school, if I'm in that meeting, if I can't even get a sentence out, or if I say something, even if I know it's really a good point, it's not so much what I say, it's because I'm a woman, it will be completely dismissed. And I see it over and over again. Mm-hmm. I'm not a young assistant professor, you know. You as a scientist, you observe, you induce, right? Or deduce, induction, deduction, I always can get those confused. But, you know, you observe things and you look for patterns, and it's so true. Just happened to me recently. You asked about the climate in the university. The climate, many parts of the university, is very, very good. Mm-hmm. And even in places in the medical school, we have a new chair. I've been through four chairs. I have never had a chair actually ask me what I thought. This new chair is wonderful. He'll call me for advice. He made me a vice chair of faculty development. So that's like a whole new day in mm-hmm. my department. Mm-hmm. But still outside my department. It's just, I mean, in some ways it's just fascinating. Because through Wisely, I now am quite familiar with the social science research on gender and evaluation mm-hmm. and, you know,
how do you think that's typical of medical schools?
Yeah,
it is.
But I do think we're worse than most. Mm-hmm. And we're at the bottom. When you look at the number of women faculty, we're like, you know, in the bottom five. I mean, mm-hmm. we're really not doing well.
Mm-hmm. Now there's a new dean coming, right?
We're all hopeful.
Well, I think I read an article or in the paper, I think, and he said the right thing.
He said the right thing. You know, it was so funny, wasn't it? So they asked the current dean, whose name shall be, who shall be nameless, like, you know, what do you think about, why can't you keep any senior women in the medical school? Give him enough rope. He hung himself. Did you read that? It was so absurd. He goes, well, you know, women physicians early in their careers are just too distracted. You're like, why do you think we're not making any progress?
Oh, dear.
Yeah, so we're hoping the new dean will be better. But, you know, the biases against women I've come to learn with studying the research through Wisely are so deep and so widely pervasive. Women have them, too. We all have biases against women. I mean, study after study after study after study shows, given identical work, if we think it's done by a woman, both men and women, if we think it's done by a woman, we'll give it a lower evaluation.
Hmm.
Then the identical work, if we put a man's name on it, we'll think it's better. So, you know, we have that to work against.
Yeah. Am I right that the majority of medical students now are women?
Some schools are the majority. Some it's 53%, but nationally it's about 50%. Yep. Okay.
What about moving into faculty positions? Is that I realize that we don't have a lot of women faculty now, but are there more women coming in where that might change?
Well, I mean, you would think they would have to be. I said, you know, if you know biology, there's passive transport and active transport and passive diffusion. And I said, you know, by passive diffusion alone, even if there's no active transport, we would have to eventually get more women. So it is glacially slow, but of course there's creep. But there are very few senior women
in most medical schools, but again, we are worse than most. But mm-hmm. So we have 8.6% of our physician faculty, of our tenured physician faculty, are women. We are not even in double digits.
Oh my.
Now, the basic scientists, the PhDs, are doing better. I believe they're something like 22% now, maybe 24%. They are doing better. But because the clinical departments, and the literature would predict this, research would predict this, whenever you have high prestige, high salary, it's always going to push it toward hiring men. Mm-hmm. And we just got our first woman faculty chair. Hmm. And what is she in? Peds.
Oh.
Not surgery, mm-hmm. right, not, but peds, which is great. But that would be predicted. Mm-hmm. One would predict that you would be more likely to have your first chair in a I don't want to say anything against pediatrics, but a lower prestige mm-hmm. chairmanship.
Mm-hmm.
Not the Department of Medicine, not surgery, right. But peds, yeah.
Yeah. Now, do you see Wisely continuing on campus for a long time?
I hope so.
I know, I read something where there's a bit of a,
so.
Of a concern for finances
well,
there, too.
Well, it was a 5-year non-renewable grant.
Hmm.
So, obviously, if we were allowed to go back in, just like most research grants, we
sure.
would go back in because the life cycle grant is only one example of success that we have. If we have time at the end, I can tell you about our work with the search committees. So I think we're doing a lot on campus, and our name is recognized. I see us profiled in things the chancellor says. You know, we're doing all this wonderful stuff, and Wisely's doing this. We've been working hard. We've written a grant. We're trying to cobble together funds from multiple sources, which is like we've done here. So mm-hmm. I'm familiar with cobbling. So we got the College of Engineering will commit to allowing us to use one of their financial support people that is supported by the College of Engineering, even after our funds go away. And campus is committed to supporting at least part of Jen's salary, Jen Sherritt, our research director, executive director. And, it's going to be the big loss will be faculty involvement, I think, because Joe and I will have to go back and do what pays us, because mm-hmm. right now 40% of my salary is coming from NSF and I think 10% of Joe's.
Mm-hmm.
So we're paid to actually
sure.
do this stuff, develop these programs and write these other grants. And so when that goes away, then that's going to be hard. And then the other staff too, to develop the brochures and things like that. Our evaluator, it'd be gone. But we're trying, we're writing grants. I have two more grants to write, one in June and one in November that may pay for some of our people.
Are there programs like this in other research institutions?
Well, there's 20 Advanced Institutional Transformation Awards from NSF, so we're one of 20.
Okay, and so you're all getting to the, are they, were they all
Well, they
funded?
Were in different cycles. So
oh,
we
were
in
okay.
the first 9 funded,
mm-hmm.
And then there have been 2 other cycles, so there's 20, and I think there's 2 new ones coming, so maybe 22.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wish you luck. I hope you can find the funds. It's really an important program.
Well, and it's been so much fun,
yeah.
too. It's just, it's been such a fun grant.
Well, talk about the search committees. How are you involved in the search committees?
Well, once we became aware of all this research on gender and its impact on evaluation, we, of course, wanted to get this out to people. We're,
mm-hmm.
We're teachers, educators, researchers, we're like, well, if people know the data, it'll help them.
Mm-hmm.
And at least help them understand why it's so hard to change things. So we said, well, we need to focus on kind of the gatekeeping areas, hiring committees being a big gatekeeping area because people come here and they like it. So if you can't impact the hires, you can't change the complexion of the university for decades. So we said, well, we'll design teaching modules to work with the search committees to train them on biases and assumptions. So we had a design team, and we tried to include a lot of people on it, people from Bascom, people from Wisely, people from, then it was Linda Green's office. And anyway, so we designed this module, and that brochure came out of it that everybody's seen. I don't know if you've seen that brochure. And so we had one of our first ones, and at the end, people said, well, you know, thank you very much, Molly. This is really interesting, but we really also want to know was how does one run a search committee? And then we realized there's one of the most important functions on campus, recruiting the next generation. There was no training. So we backed up and said, okay, let's just incorporate that stuff into how to run a search. Because if people don't know how to even, you know, run a meeting, if they don't know how to do these basic mechanics of running a search committee, then it's not going to work anyway. Because, you know, whenever something's ambiguous or not, well, then it always sort of defaults to status quo. So I don't have them here to show you. They're all over in the Wisely office. But working closely with Eve Fine, who's our researcher, and Jen, and really everybody, the evaluator, everybody worked on it. We have now a workbook for our workshops. It has five modules. We divided the search and screen process into five modules. And we have run sessions with multiple search committee members now across campus. In fact, Gary Sandifer, when he became dean of LNS, required search committee chairs to participate in these training sessions or they wouldn't get a position. That was the first one. It was required. Otherwise, it's voluntary. Anyway, so we just looked at the data, and a department in which at least one person in that department attended one of our training sessions versus departments where nobody participated in any of our training sessions. Those that participated, the number of women faculty being offered and accepting and coming. So the offers as well as people coming went up compared to before. Those that didn't went down.
Oh my.
The number of women and the percent, yeah. Isn't that interesting?
It really is. Yeah.
So we think that's kind of successful.
Absolutely. What can be done to encourage more girls to get involved in science, or is that really not a problem in the medical school? It sounds like it's not.
Well, I think we've succeeded at the early levels. Now, certainly not in physical sciences. There's still only about, I think, 8 or 9%. Still very low in the physical sciences. But here, that's where we've made our biggest gains. Of course, you know, you could say, well, they had the biggest gains to make, which is still true, and they're still the lowest. But since Wisely came in, we've just seen a huge change there. So electrical engineering had one woman faculty for like a decade. Now they have three. There had never been a woman chair in engineering. Now there is. And the physical sciences that are in LNS, I think of the 11 physical science departments last year, five were chaired by women. So we really are seeing a lot of improvement there.
Yeah, that's very good. Discuss the professional organizations to which you belong and to the and the extent of your involvement. I'm sure you do this in your spare time, your professional involvement.
Well, it's sort of peripatetic. I was, of course, involved in the geriatrics ones. But when I got interested in women's health, even though to me it was like a no-brainer because most of our patients in geriatrics are women, walk through a nursing home, it's like 80% women. And all the research looks at, you know, sex and gender differences. But still, once I went into women's health, people would say, oh, so I hear you're not in geriatrics anymore, you're in women's health. It was really interesting. And they weren't, I don't know, quite going where I was going. So I joined more organizations that were interested in the same thing I was. So I'm in the Association of Academic Women's Health Programs, and I don't know what else. I'm still a member of the geriatrics, but I'm not, well, that one I'm active in, but not the other two.
Would you talk about any honors and awards you've received over the years?
Well, I got a whole spate of awards a few years ago. It was really interesting. It was like, I think I got like four awards in, you know, 2 years. No, I don't think I ever got anything before. I never got anything since. So I think what happens is once, you know, people put together your packet, they don't want to waste it, so they submit it to all. So yeah, I got something from the AMA, and I got the Cabinet 99. And the,
wait, what's Cabinet 99?
It's I think it's like the UW Women's Alumni Group.
Oh yeah. And, okay. Well, so you talk though. Tell us what it is.
Oh well, I think that's what it is. It's the UW Women's Alumni, and they pick every other year somebody, a woman faculty member who has done a lot to try to advance other women faculty
mm-hmm.
members.
Mm-hmm.
So that was nice. And I had the YWCA Women of Distinction Award. That was nice.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got this national award from the AAMC, which is the Association of Academic Medical Colleges, that the, I don't know, Woman of the Year or something like that. So yeah, it was very nice. It was very nice. So.
I'm sure there will be more.
I'm trying to nominate lots of other women. So we got Joe Handelsman this year as a woman. Well, this one doesn't have the picture. But anyway, Joe Handelsman.
I got that.
Isn't that great? Mm-hmm. So
very
we nominated
good.
Her for that.
Mm-hmm. I'm through with all of the questions on your career. But if there's any, and then I have a final questions on your family life and what you do for fun and relaxation when you're not working. But is there anything else that you want to talk about in terms of your career here, either Wisely or your research or women's
health? I feel very fortunate. I mean, I don't think there's a better job in the world than being a tenured professor at an academic medical center. And even though I do complain about my computer, the truth is, I mean, I work with such nice people.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pleasure to come to work every day, even though I do complain about my computer. I'm sure they get tired of it. They put up with me complaining about my computer. Oh, there's Molly complaining about her computer again. But overall, I mean, it really it's wonderful to have the opportunity to mentor particularly women physicians toward academic careers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I say I try to create the training programs I always wanted, never had. And that's just so gratifying. And I just feel really fortunate to be in a position to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're not at an academic medical center, if you don't have, you know, the title of being a professor at the University of Wisconsin, you can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
So it allows you to do that.
Mm-hmm. Very good. So what do you do when you're not here, when you're away from work?
You know, I always say, like, you know, they say how Eskimos have, like, 10 words for snow. I always say we should have 10 words for work, because what I, you know, like writing or thinking or reading or studying or looking up something new, I don't find that work. I really mm-hmm. find that energizing. To me, work is like doing the laundry, you know, yard work, cooking. I mean, that stuff I dread. So, if you know, when I'm not working, I would actually be doing those other things that might be called work. But then, you know, sometimes you do just need a break from everything. And then, you know, I don't know, I travel with my husband and go to movies with my family and just kind of sit around.
You said you have children?
Yeah, they're older now, but they're both in town. So my son is 24, and he has his own video production company, Off Track Production.
Hmm.
And my daughter is a sophomore here.
Well, I don't have any other questions. Is there anything else you'd like to add to this interview before we end?
I can't imagine anybody will ever listen to this. It'll probably be so boring.
Oh, you'd be surprised. You'd be surprised. Well, I really appreciate this. Thank you very much.
Oh, thanks so much for giving me a chance to talk about myself.